this week. The markets paused ahead of next week's FOMC meeting, where policymakers are expected to raise the national lending rate. Welcome back, everyone. Just great to rejoin you this week. And your host, Chris Waltzek, with more guest interviews. In just 3 months, the yellow metal is higher by $50, while silver is up about a dollar. So a reaction is expected. Bill Murphy from GATA says the gold cartel is back at work in the silver market, making it tough for the gold bull. Another plausible explanation, Janet Yellen and company will likely raise rates next week. We weren't expecting that until June or July of this summer, so it certainly caught many investors and institutions off guard. So just what might drive three-digit silver? Well, according to Zero Hedge, 160 million Americans, that's over half the country, would have trouble facing a $500 emergency expense. Many of us are struggling today. The economy looks robust. Still, half of America not in the best financial shape. Are people really able to accumulate some type of precious metals insurance policy to protect them from looming inflation? Plus, we discussed the fact that there's roughly 2,000 billionaires worldwide. That's $6.5 trillion in total. If just one of those folks, like, for instance, Hugo Salinas Price, a well-known silver aficionado, decided to corner the silver market, would have little trouble. Very few institutions or pension funds have even a modicum of gold, less than 0.1% in the portfolio. So there's plenty of pent-up potential demand out there to send these markets flying. And then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Partly cloudy skies persisted for the second week over the precious metals sector as investors continued to brace for a stealth rate hike at next week's FOMC meeting. Gold finished the week off $25, just 2%, closing at $12.01, while silver fell 82 cents, 4.5%, finishing just shy of 17. The precious metals XAU finished off only 2.3 points. At around 80, and black gold, though, was hit by almost $5, down 9% to 48.50, following news that the active rig count data continued to increase for the eighth week in a row. Lastly, Bitcoin, though, bucked the trend, soaring higher, up 6 points, 4.5%, at 135, approaching new all-time record highs on ETF GBTC. The top story driving the precious metal sector this week, news of solid unemployment numbers from the U.S. Labor Department on Friday. The U.S. added 235,000 new jobs in February, better than economists' forecasts, giving Fed officials adequate wiggle room for a rate hike at next week's FOMC meeting slated for the 14th and the 15th. U.S. companies hired new employees at a rapid clip in February, particularly in the construction and manufacturing sectors. The current Fed funds futures reading suggests virtually a lock on next week's rate hike. Precious metals bottom line. Although the selling was intense this week in the sector, the XAU is showing some signs of bottoming, which is viewed as a positive as the shares tend to lead the sector. In addition, the U.S. dollar had every reason to blast to new highs, but instead declined, suggesting that investors have already factored next week's rate hike into the market and the metals could perhaps find a floor in the coming weeks. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly cloudy skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange as investors locked in some profits ahead of next week's rate hike. Higher rates makes corporate expansion more costly while reducing the ability to raise funds through new debt issuance. Rate hikes are also emblematic of a healthy economy, adding support for the continued stock market bullish trend. By Friday's close, the Dow Industrials was off only 103, less than 0.5%, ending at 2902, while the S&P fell about 11 points, down to 2373, and the NASDAQ was off just 9, finishing at 5861. Meanwhile, the national unemployment rate dropped to 4.7%, while hourly pay increased 2.8% from February 2016. Market analysts view the growth in the manufacturing sector is particularly healing for the economy as production of new goods tends to spill over into adjacent sectors, benefiting the entire economy. However, the ECB took a less deflationary stance as economic conditions are less robust in the EU. Economic ministers held rates steady at this week's meeting. Bottom line on equities. As anticipated in the last report, the Dow finally succumbed to some selling pressure. Nevertheless, the greed fear index, as well as U.S. housing starts, among many of our favorite economic indicators, suggest this is just a blip and perhaps even just a pause before a consolidation and run to Dow 22,000. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. We'd like for you to stay with us.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. What's interesting this week is that both the mainstream media and the internet are alive with discussions, speculations, disbelief, shock, occasional denial, and a consistent undertone of both fear and anger about the alleged revelations involving not the surveillance of Trump Tower. No, if it were just that, it would once again be something relegated to a partisan issue that would be dismissed into the black hole of election politics. No, this is something that strikes much closer to home for the average person. The WikiLeaks Vault 7 documents allege that the intelligence community has and utilizes the capability to monitor average citizens through their iPhones, smart TVs, and computer apps, even when these devices are apparently turned off. It's been discussed openly in the mainstream media this week how hacks, who by the way can be anyone, can break into a system, perform their mischief, and then leave electronic fingerprints of other people, other countries, or anyone they want to frame as the perpetrator of the alleged incident. The mere fact that this level of infighting and public disclosure is taking place at such high levels is indicative of a major internal turf war occurring at the highest levels of the unelected ruling class. The public will ultimately learn and adapt, align and redirect. Old ways of doing things will grow obsolete, to the surprise of those doing them. Like trying to win elections with centralized, authoritarian control of the media. Any average citizen who has followed the advancement of the surveillance state for the past several decades has most likely kept those thoughts private, because there has been no meaningful outlet for those discussions. But if you go back to the original revelations on Prism, Echelon, Carnivore, and the many surveillance systems which preceded these, all of which you can find discussed on Wikipedia, the evolution toward the capabilities being discussed today, as if they are somehow new bombshell revelations, are not a surprise at all. They are a natural evolution of their predecessors and have been known for some time. But while all this has been taking place, the TikTok inching us closer and closer to some kind of economic reset keeps inching forward in the shadows. Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, from my home state of Wisconsin, is a master of political doublespeak, especially on Obamacare. He gave the most elusive, incongruent responses to Tucker Carlson this week when discussing that subject, always short-circuiting any criticism of his delay in repealing certain aspects of Obamacare by invoking the complexities of the budget process that even certain members of his own party don't understand. And by extension, Tucker surely doesn't understand. So let's move on and not waste any time with complexities the American people surely aren't going to understand, other than they need to take Paul Ryan's word for it. And we can surely trust Paul Ryan, can't we? Then there's the whole debt ceiling issue, a trap that was likely put in place for what was assumed at the time would be a Hillary Clinton presidency. This may result in a short-term government shutdown, which may not be such a bad idea. And if it occurs, even if it doesn't, an executive order to place every member of Congress and their families on Obamacare without recourse until such time as the system is truly reformed might be just what the doctor ordered, to fast-track real change for the rest of us. But with all the talk of secrets apparently making their way into the public discourse, the one secret that remains bigger than the methodology of the intelligence apparatus is the true nature of gold and silver relative to the U.S. dollar. The secret nature of the Fed and its interventions into the gold market since the early 90s is one of the greatest secrets never told officially. If WikiLeaks wants to shed light on something that will truly change the global monetary system, then perhaps their next installment, call it Vault 8, will feature the behind-the-scenes machinations of what our good friend Alan Greenspan, Uncle Ben Bernanke, and Janet Yellen have been doing with regard to our precious metals. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus Plus, their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Arriva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Bill Murphy, head of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, got it with Chris Powell, exposing market manipulation in the precious metals sector. Welcome back, Bill Murphy.
Great to be back, Chris. Thanks.
Great. I hope it's a lovely day in Dallas, Texas.
It's been a whole lovely winter. It's unbelievable. So I went down to Acapulco to make a presentation at Jeff Berwick's conference, and I had to cool down. It was 89 degrees when I left Dallas, and it was 80 when I got to Acapulco.
Maybe that's an indication of global warming after all.
Made me a believer, that's for sure.
We just had Andrew McGuire, I know, a friend of GATA, a big hitter, particularly gold manipulation. He was on the show, made some time for us. And does he make a powerful case that GATA has just been on the right trail for about 15 years? The short sellers are caught naked here at the COMEX 92-1, and we should see 2,000 on the yellow metal within the next 3 to 6 months.
Andrew, I have the greatest admiration for, will be my hero if that happens. I would just like to see some evidence of what my friend Andrew is talking about in terms of the market action, which is just awful. You know, when silver, talk about manipulation, as I'm sure your listeners know, they bombed it for nearly 80 cents on Thursday for no reason. Then took it with an $18 handle plus near $18.50, and now we're below $17. And it's just outrageous. And they're looking to wipe out the specs again, the spec long, for the open interest there is the highest it's ever been in history outside of last year. And in terms of gold, I mean, Andrew's as smart as they come, and he's got connections that I don't have over there in London. And there's no doubt in my mind that what he's talking about is right on the money. The question is, are the bad guys, or this gold cartel, as we call it, are they going one more time to flush the spec longs out so they can cover their short positions before this will occur? And I'm rooting for Andrew to be right. Again, he knows what he's talking about, and I just would like to see some signs of it playing out versus going through this aggravation that we're going through today.
Obviously, we're seeing the Fed Funds futures contracts turn topsy-turvy following the Fed head chairwoman Janet Yellen, as well as her colleagues there. Policymakers have had a big change of heart. There's a sea change at the FOMC. I guess it's slated for next week, 14th, 15th. It looks like they're going to likely raise rates 2 or 3 months ahead of time, calling a stealth rate increase. You know, some of the hedge funds and institutional advisors and investors are adjusting to this new event following comments from our policymakers last week.
Well, you know, this is, they wanted to make a lot of the sense. And of course, you know, the price action makes the market commentary, which I keep talking about and have for many years. The interest rate went from where it was to zero to less than zero. And what did it do for gold? It went straight down. It had nothing to do with the gold price. But they know how to maneuver these markets. And as I said, they just attacked last Thursday and they're burying the thing. And now they're scaring the specs out, which is what they do. And you've got the 15th coming up with the Fed rate hike day and also the debt ceiling. That issue's coming to the fore, in which they'll do what they always do and argue back and forth and then raise the ceiling. It'll be a non-issue, I'm sure. The only thing I could say is that after we've had rate rises in the past, that the gold and silver have taken off again. You know, the fundamentals are, you know, I'm a believer that these are ridiculously low artificial prices, and they're going to just explode. And that's probably what's going to happen, Chris. We're going to go through this aggravation over and over again, and then they're just going to explode out of nowhere. But that's just my opinion.
No, I think the charts back up your thoughts. We see bottoming behavior, the silver market. I know it has been hit hard. It was due, though, a correction after 9 straight weeks higher. I mean, come on, 9 weeks of higher highs and higher lows.
Yeah, but if I may interrupt there, but look how it went up. I mean, going up 2 pennies was a big deal versus 1 penny. It was agonizing. It was, and now they just attack, and they're wiping the whole thing out in a few days.
But I think this is the type of action we see as you carve out a bottom. I think we've been doing that now for about a year. And if you look at the weekly charts, silver, I think, is the strongest, really, technically, of them all. Because you have that big golden cross, 50 over the 200. We haven't seen anything like that in years. This type of, as you say, agonizing sideways market action, you know, I'd direct folks back to 2010. For 12 months, it couldn't break $15 an ounce. And then suddenly, this eruption, our three-year-old is now into volcanoes. Discovered magma and lava. Just loved to see silver explode, just like one of these most active volcanoes in the world is now active. I mean, I think we get the eruption that you talked about earlier. And Andrew McGuire, yeah, he agrees with you. I mean, he says, look, they don't have 400 tons of gold to drop, the BOE, this time around. They don't have the ammunition so that when things do start to get out of control, the train just goes off the tracks.
Well, no, I listened to what Andrew said about the comment made about that they were from the Bank of England, they were looking into the abyss, and I think that's going to happen again. The question is, what is it going to take to turn things around? When we had this move in 2010 and 11, the open interest in silver was average 130, 135, 125,000 all the way up. The bad guys, the J.P. Morgan crowd, were not there. Now the open interest is 190, 195,000. And that is the bad guy saying, we're not going anyplace. So until they are forced to retreat or the physical market overpowers them, people like me are not going to be correct. I mean, I'm a $100 silver guy, but we thought this was going to happen last year. And yes, I think you're absolutely right. It's going to be like a Mount Vesuvius. But can't wait to see some sign of it occurring. And so far, we see nothing.
I'm also impatient with silver. I'm seeing some signs. I see some footprints. We're looking at the same charts. I mean, I'm watching the weekly chart. I'm looking at it as a reaction and an ongoing basing period for the next launch higher. And it just reminds me of 2010. This went on for almost a year. And then it was a launch pad, and you couldn't subdue it. It was like the bunker's dream come true.
Chris, again, I'll point out that the bad guys let it go. The open interest was 50,000, 60,000 contracts less than it is today. In other words, they weren't there to stop it. And all the way up, it hardly ever moved. They weren't there. So we have to get rid of this J.P. Morgan crowd. The gold cartel has got to be forced to retreat.
Another article just out this week, a big study. I don't derive any pleasure in saying this, but half of Americans can't pull together $500 for an emergency. That's 160 plus million people. That means every other person you meet today, one out of every two people you run across, falls into this camp, and they aren't buying gold and silver. People are chasing stocks. They're looking at their 401ks. And something similar occurred with the housing market. Remember, everyone was just counting the dollars, you know, going to Trulia and Zillow and saying, look how valuable my house is, where in reality it was maybe worth a quarter of that. I think this is what's going to happen to people's 401ks, and then the institutional money and the smart money will be chasing gold and silver, and that's where the inelastic demand and inelastic supply takes hold. I just see these reactions as a buying opportunity, and I know we're as impatient as Bill Murray.
Well, you know, we're in the same boat. I'm just trying to lay it out as best I can. I can tell you this. The sentiment is as bad as I've ever seen it in 18 years. Part of that's due because of the U.S. stock market soaring and gold and silver getting hit and that the shares have been tanking badly. I'm supposed to speak at a conference or a symposium in Brussels in the third, fourth week in April, and they may not even have it. Peter Schiff was the featured speaker last year. I was supposed to be it this year because the quote is from my host, a wonderful guy. He's never seen it so bad as it is right now, and that's in Europe. So what they have done to create this atmosphere following the unexpected Trump victory has just worked to perfection, and they've got everybody going one way, as you say, in the market. And they're getting everybody to run away from gold and silver. Just one thing, I couldn't agree with you more. They should be looking at it. But that's not the way it's working right now.
And I'd also throw in here comments from a pretty solid economic think tank where they just point out bullet after bullet after bullet. Precious metals aren't on your radar screen and stocks are, you know, the investment du jour. But this thing is going to turn around. They called it a flock of black swans that are just on the horizon. People are going to be glad they use these low discounted prices to, you know, boost their allocation. Please tell people more about Gata.org and La Metropole Cafe.
Well, they can sign up for Chris Powell. My colleague does a great job at, as he said, www.gata.org, and he sends out stuff all the time. And again, he's in contact with the media and has been at it ever since we started. And I have lemetropolecafe.com, and people can sign up for a two-week free trial, see if it's a value. And again, I couldn't agree with you more that this thing is going to drive us nuts. And then it's going to, when we go up, we're not going up like we did in the years past. It's going to explode. So now's the time for people to pay attention and listen to you, Chris.
Are we talking about gap up, block limit up in the futures markets?
Something's going to happen. I think you mentioned these black swans that are, we haven't had a black swan in so long, I forget what they look like. I mean, it just, as you said, they're building, but nothing has had an impact yet. When it does, you're going to get an Andrew McGuire kind of thing where all of a sudden we hit the tipping point in which this gold cartel can't come up with enough. They'll be overpowered by demand from these black swan events, will not be able to cover their positions, and I know that's what Andrew got into, and that's what can create this upside volatile action. So, and because, think about Newton's law again, I always like to use this analogy where, you know, equal and opposite reactions. Because of what they've done to decimate gold and silver for too long at too low prices, when we go next time, we're not going up gradually, in my opinion. It's going to be explosive, the kind of thing you're talking about.
It wouldn't take but just one Hugo Salinas price. And think now, we have hundreds, if not thousands, of billionaires around the world. Just one billionaire to direct it at the silver market, or maybe the coordinated efforts. You know, you might think of it like OPEC or some cartel, a group of really heavy-hitting hedge funds. Pension funds, according to one of our favorite guests on the show here, have less than one-tenth of 1% invested in the precious metals. And the regular industry adage on Wall Street is at least 5-10%. Bill Murphy, it's always a pleasure. We'll look forward to having you back on the show, sir.
Hopefully we'll be flying by then, Chris. Thanks very much.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, my featured guest today says the economic collapse of 2008 and 2009 really led to a great recession that may still be underway. There just hasn't been the recovery reported by the mainstream media outlets. John Williams from Shadow Stats joins us on this holiday. Happy Thanksgiving, John Williams.
Well, and a happy Thanksgiving to you, too. Thank you so much for having me.
You've really disseminated some fascinating information. This would have some folks burned at the stake a few generations ago. According to your work, if you can believe the headline numbers, unemployment in this country, national unemployment, peaked at around 10% during the Great Recession, and since then has slowly declined to under 5%. I think it was 4.8 or 4.9 at last look. You're not convinced of this. Your numbers say that the alternative unemployment measure, which counts discouraged and displaced workers, actually remained static at around 20 to 23%, impacts every level of the economy. Give us the implications of your work.
I've been a private consulting economist for 30 plus years, and early on I found I had to get a real solid idea as to what the government was doing with their numbers in order to give meaningful forecasts to my clients. What I found over time was that what the government was reporting, those numbers were diverging. Over time, I found that basically Main Street USA has a lot better idea of where economic reality is than the headline economic statistics. A lot of it is how you define the numbers. With the unemployment rate, it's very specifically a matter of definition where the headline unemployment rate, the one that right now is down at what some on the Fed are claiming is a full employment level of 5%, roughly 5%. That's nonsense. The way they define it, it's a measure of, to be counted as unemployed, you have to be out of work and you have to have been actively looking for work in the last 4 weeks. It's a matter of definition. The to be counted as unemployed, in the headline numbers, you have to obviously be out of work, but you also have to have been actively looking for work in the last 4 weeks. If you haven't been actively looking for work, let's say you've been unemployed for 6 months and you're just not finding any jobs and you give up looking for, but you still want a job, the government considers you a discouraged worker. It's a term they use. And they'll put you in a separate category that takes you out of the headline labor force. The headline labor force, when you look at how they calculate the unemployment rate, the labor force is just the number of employed plus the number of unemployed. And the unemployment rate's the number of unemployed divided by the labor force. So if you're counted as unemployed and a part of the labor force and the unemployment rate's at 5%, that's a much lower level of unemployed count than I see. And the guy who's been unemployed for a period of time and has stopped looking, he just drops out. Drops out of the government's numbers. Now, they'll count him for a while in the government's broadest unemployment measure. They have six measures called U6. And there he'll be counted a year as a discouraged worker, but after a year, he's no longer counted as a discouraged worker, just dropped from that. The difference is right now that the headline unemployment's around 5%. The U6, which is the broadest government measure, is around 10%. But once they drop out of the headline measure, and the same thing happens after a year, if they're discouraged, they're no longer counted. Well, back before 1984, when they changed the system around, and that's because we were getting NAFTA put into place, and there was a lot of expectation that it was going to cost people jobs, and it wouldn't be too good a political idea to show the long-term discouraged workers. So they changed the way they defined the series. If you add back in the long-term discouraged workers, the displaced workers, occasionally economic downturns as we've had, I estimate it's up around, the unemployment rate right now is up around 23%. Putting that in perspective, I'll contend that if you went around the country was unemployed, that's about the number you'd get. It's because of the underlying reality there, the economy is worse than what the government's reporting, probably more so than anything else that gave us the political overthrow we've just seen in the presidential race. Mr. Trump picked up on the fact that people responded, and he's now the president-elect. What's happening here? Back in 92, George Bush was running for re-election. The economy was had been in a recession, and there were people associated with the administration who went out and GDP numbers boosted the GDP. The recession ended. Hip, hip, hooray, except that nobody believed it. George Bush didn't get reelected. Economic well-being, the pocketbook issues, more than anything else, tend to drive presidential elections. And you can see that when it's been below generally 3%, when the real disposable income has been below 3%, adjusted for inflation, the incumbent party has always lost the White House. That's since 1932 when you have the first numbers. Other issues, of course, here other than just the employment. You have the payroll employment. You have that's probably more of a market driver than the unemployment rate. It's a survey that's conducted of industry in terms of how many people they have on payrolls. So that if someone actually has a part-time job, or two part-time jobs, or three part-time jobs, where the payroll gets reported to the government, they're counted three times as being a household survey where you only get counted once, irrespective of how many jobs you're holding down. So when you see a surge in payrolls, that sometimes reflects more people taking on multiple jobs, but they also have upside bias factors that were added into that system back in the 80s. In the coming out of the 1983 recession, the Bureau of Labor Statistics was in an embarrassing political situation where they actually underestimated the number of jobs being created coming out of that recession. So what they did was they put in what they called a bias factor, adding in about 160,000 jobs per month for good measure, so they didn't have to worry about understating the employment. And that varied some over time, and as they received some criticism on it, they formalized the model. Now it's called the birth-death model. But basically, it's a fudge factor, adding a couple hundred thousand jobs a month in there to, for good measure, to keep the numbers on the plus side. The GDP. Now that's the broadest measure of the U.S. economy. It's what most people will follow. You say, what's the economy doing? They'll look at the GDP and say, oh, here's what the GDP's doing. Well, it's the broadest measure of the economy. It's currently published. But it is very heavily politicized, very heavily gimmicked, very heavily modeled. If you believe the GDP reporting, the economy crashed from late 2007, collapsed into 2009, and then rebounded. And it now stands about 13% above where it was before the recession, above the prior peak in the economy before the recession. That's adjusted for inflation. That's the way they normally look at it. The problem is there's nothing else that's showing that. If you look at industrial production, which accounts for roughly 65% of the GDP, right now that's down something like 1.5% from its pre-recession peak. The manufacturing sector there is down 6% from its pre-recession peak. Never recovered. Retail sales are higher, and there's some reasons for that. Basically, poor quality and adjustment for inflation. But even there, with the spike numbers, they're up 5% from the pre-recession peak. You look at elements such as the cash freight index, broad measure of freight activity, broad measure of economic activity. It's down year to year, still falling. You look at housing. You're down, depending upon the measure, anywhere between 30% and 60% from the pre-recession peak. Very difficult to come up with that kind of growth that they're advertising in the GDP. And as a result, most people don't believe the GDP numbers. They also think that inflation is understated, and they're correct. Again, it's a matter of definition. And in this case, you had a very open effort by the government to understate inflation. Changes that were made go back to the 1980s, but where it came before the public was in the 1990s, with Alan Greenspan and who headed a commission with his name. The way Greenspan explained it was that the CPI overstated inflation. And if only it stated inflation correctly, it would save the government a lot of money because it wouldn't have to pay as much in cost of living benefits for things such as Social Security. It would also push people into higher tax brackets so they'd pay higher income taxes. Well, if you ask them, what are you talking about? And how is it overstating inflation? The example he'd give is, well, suppose steak gets very expensive. People buy more hamburger instead of steak. Their cost is not going to be as high. Therefore, their cost of living is less, but that's not reflected in the CPI. Well, this is where you get into definition, because that is indeed a matter of definition. Additional consumer price indices, and this is the way it was up until they started changing these numbers, measured what's referred to as maintaining a constant standard of living. If you want to use a CPI measure to estimate how much your income has to increase by or what you're targeting your investment return at in order to stay ahead of inflation, you want to be able to do so so that you don't have to cut back on your standard of living. You want to be able to maintain your standard of living consistent with at least with what's happening in inflation. And if you have to cut back on steak because it's getting too expensive relative to hamburger and buy more hamburger, that's not maintaining a constant standard of living. So what they did was they moved to change the CPI to sort of a substitution-based index. It hasn't been done fully successfully yet. They've made all sorts of gimmicked changes to the CPI, but they've also developed a new series called the CPI, the CCPI, the chained CPI, which in the not-too-distant future, we'll see what happens with a new government, but as it was planned, would become the new cost of living measure that would enable them to further cut cost of living adjustments for people on Social Security. If you're on Social Security and you don't think the payments that the increases you're getting cover your cost of living, you're absolutely correct. And it's designed that way basically to save the government money. The government is not putting out a more accurate CPI measure. It's not but putting out a CPI measure in terms of what do I need to stay ahead of inflation. They just redefined it so that they'd come up with the smallest inflation possible that cut their expenditures. So you have factors like those. The inflation changes affect the reported growth rate. You look at the GDP, not as strong as advertised. One reason for that is that it has in it very low inflation numbers that are used in deflating the series. But if you're looking at economic growth, you only want to look at it with inflation removed. Now, let's say you run a store and you look at your cash register and your sales are up 10% from last year. Well, if inflation's up 10% from last year, then you're basically break even after inflation. It's important to know what inflation is. If you deflate by too low a rate of inflation, it increases the inflation-adjusted growth rate. And right now we're seeing a general understatement, inflation rate used in calculating the GDP. It's an aggregate number, about 2 percentage points, which happens to be just about what the GDP has been growing almost exactly year after year, quarter after quarter when you average it out. It's almost like someone was targeting 2% growth per year. The difference it makes, and what I'll contend has happened here, is that instead of the economy crashing from 2007 into 2009 and then rebounding, it started turning down late 2005, 2006, crashed indeed into 2009, and bounced off absolute bottom, but then it effectively leveled out at a low level of stagnation and never recovered, and now it's starting to turn down again. You'll see that again, and then if you look at the housing numbers, you look at industrial production, you'll see it in a number of the broader employment measures that the government puts out, like the participation rate, which is also something along the lines of discouraged workers. You see rates there that are indicating that low level of participation in the workforce, low level of the population that's actually employed. These are the lowest levels seen basically since 1994, which is when they redefine the series. So that it's there are a number of factors that are confirming it out there. It's just that you just have to take the headline government numbers with a large grain of salt.
Exactly. No, we keep our grains of salt in dump trucks at goldseek.com. You brought up some really interesting points. I'd like to underscore at least one of them that I think has broad-based implications for all of our listeners today. And this will be a bit repetitive, I think, for our longer-term listeners, but for new folks, it bears repeating. If inflation is understated, as I understand it, our GDP deflator is also incorrect. So it appears as though, according to the official numbers, that the economy might be in recovery and the recession is in the rearview mirror. But when we look at the shadow stats numbers that have been at least theoretically corrected, more realistic, plausible inflation numbers, you immediately see that we've been in a recession for approximately 15 years, that meaningful work is more difficult than ever to find, and the actual recovery just seems to be the 0.1%.
The other side of that is basically lost some of his what used to be very strong employment opportunities, and a good deal of that is tied to trade deals. Again, this brings you back to some of the current issues that are being discussed in Washington, and factors that again helped Mr. Trump in his campaign were the reasonably easy time identifying with the problem. The problem with the trade deals. Free trade is a wonderful concept, and I love people in academia, but the problem of some of the theories they come up with is that they're handling such complex areas that they have to make simplifying assumptions, and you got to look real closely at those simplifying assumptions because that can affect the way things evolve. And the simplifying assumption with the free trade concept is that you have, say, two countries that haven't been trading before, and one makes one product particularly with a particular efficiency, and the other country makes a different product with particular efficiency, and they open up trade, and most of the production of one product goes to the other country and the other to the other country, but overall you get greater aggregate production, greater wealth to the system, and it should be, in theory, a positive benefit to everyone. The underlying assumption is that you're at full employment, and that hasn't been the case here in a long time, nor has it been with most of our trading partners. And as a result, when you have that type of a circumstance, the benefit goes to the low wage operation, and that's why have seen factories shut down in the United States and move to the people who otherwise, they maybe were a high-paid machinist, couldn't get a job. Now they flip hamburgers. They may be employed, but they're not earning adequate income. What you'll find is that with the government's numbers, this is from the published by the Census Bureau, and they keep revising the numbers some. But if you look at their latest estimates. What was referred to as a median household income. This would be the middle level of income for a household in the United States, adjusted for their headline inflation, the CPI, CPIU. This is the one that most people follow. That adjusted for inflation, that median income now is below where it was back in the 1970s and 1980s. If you look at real average weekly earnings as published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Peak was in 1973. It's been downhill from then. And it's the reason is largely tied to the loss of the domestic productive base offshore and the higher paying jobs offshore. And again, that's a reason that you've had such economic discrimination. And again, some overturn in the political system and criticism of the trade deals. There are legitimate concerns there.
Let's move on to the U.S. dollar. Of course, the greenback has broken out to multi-decade highs recently. Many in the mainstream are at least citing the potential for another rate hike or two in 2017. And, of course, we're certainly going to see one in the December FOMC meeting, a quarter point at least. Do you believe that we will see higher rates in 2017 by our policymakers? And can you tell us just what that might mean for the domestic economy?
Yeah, I think there's a good chance the Fed's going to raise rates in December. The problem is they haven't done so other than back in December of 2015. They've been threatening it ever since. But they're bluff. The problem is that the banking system collapsed back in 2008, the panic of 2008. What the Treasury, the federal government did, I mean the Treasury and the Fed, did was basically use whatever stopgap measures they could put together without consideration of the factors that had actually generated the crisis, but to buy time, to push the crisis into the future. What the Fed and the Treasury did with that crisis in 2008, they decided that they would save the banking system at all cost. They did whatever they had to do to keep the system afloat, to push the crisis into the future. They stopgap whatever they had to bail out. They guaranteed whatever they had to guarantee. Bailed out General Motors. They purchased AIG, the largest insurance company. Bailed out the large banks. Whatever they had to do, they did. And they bought some time. But they did nothing to address the underlying issues, and the average country wants out of the U.S. Treasuries, not into them. Big buyers such as China, Japan, South Korea, they're all selling now. The biggest buyer had been the Federal Reserve. That's quantitative easing. I think they're not going to have much of a choice but to go back to that, because where they talk about launching their quantitative easing programs to help stimulate the economy, that's nonsense. The quantitative easing programs were launched to try and preserve the liquidity of the banks, to bail out the banking system. They used the weak economy as political cover, but they knew that what they were doing with quantitative easing would never stimulate the economy. The funds were not going into the economy. They were going into the banks. They were buying out off bad assets and providing the banks with liquidity. If the economy continues to turn down, which it looks like it's doing, they're going to be seeing increased stresses on the banking system. I think they've already committed to, again, salvaging the system, not letting it fail, although it effectively failed in 2008. They're still going to do whatever they can to keep the banks from collapsing, which will mean more quantitative easing. And when they move towards more quantitative easing, irrespective of whether or not they raise rates in December, you'll start to see very heavy selling against the dollar, because it means we're going to have much higher inflation down the road. And that's going to be the long-term, that's going to be the long-term issue. The U.S. has got it, but whether the Trump administration, if they have all sorts of stimulus packages in hand, that's wonderful. But they have to get around the problems they have with the Fed. The Fed is not able to handle its current circumstance, and it has to do something to satisfy the rest of the world, so people will want to continue investing in the United States, which means putting together some kind of a long-range package to guarantee the solvency of the United States over time. Right now, we have, including what they call unfunded liabilities, current value of that, the programs in hand, well in excess of $100 trillion. That's double the global economy. There's no way that can ever be paid off. So the system has to be brought into balance. And that's not going to be easy. It's not necessarily even going to be a politically popular thing to do. But if you want to have a system where you can look to returning to normal interest rates, and I think, if you're borrowing money, nobody wants to pay higher interest rates. But if you're living on a fixed income, it was nice when you used to be able to get a return on your CD that was where it was not more efficient from a monetary standpoint to just go out and buy canned goods, because, again, goods are going to go up more in value over the next year than you earn in interest.
And, of course, we've also seen yields soar and bond investors panic, obviously ahead of the increased odds for a rate hike next year and higher rates to come in the United States.
I'm not looking at a normal economy here. I see some hope, of course, with the change in government. But I don't see. I mean, I'm hopeful that maybe something can be done. But frankly, I see the decades of living beyond our means and taking on obligations that could never be covered as being intractable.
Do you believe the globalists are setting up the new regime, because here we have the threat of higher rates, which is certainly not a positive for the housing market, not to mention, the equities markets.
The higher rates are used to be normal. The issue here, though, what you've got to look at is a possibility here of a very dangerous inflation circumstance. That is set over time. I mean, if there's no change made to the obligations of the United States and our ability to meet them, eventually you're going to see a runaway inflation. That's just the effect of paying off things that you don't have covered otherwise with money you've got to print to cover it. It debases the currency. You end up with a hyperinflation.
Right. In Venezuela, we're seeing one silver coin purchase $250 in groceries right now.
Well, That's the direction I'm afraid we're going in, even with the positive changes here. But however that goes, you need to be covered in that area, and the way an individual can protect himself is to buy physical gold and silver and hold it. I prefer sovereign coins because they're liquid. Have some of your assets in that. You can write out most anything. You also probably should have a stock of emergency supplies as you would for a natural disaster. This being a man-made disaster, get stuff that you can roll over the inventory on. But if we get into as difficult a time as I think we have ahead of us, and this very easily could be in the next year or two, if prices get out of control, if the currency becomes worthless, you don't know that deliveries are going to be made to grocery stores. How are you going to get gas out of gas stations that are denominated in a couple of bucks per gallon? There are all sorts of issues that come with it. Eventually, the system will adapt. It'll adjust. You might end up with a barter system for a while. I imagine you'll eventually end up with a new currency. But it's best to have a little bit of buy yourself a little bit of an insurance policy so that you can ride out the rough times.
Do you see any dislocations or things that investors should be watching for on the horizon?
Okay, looking at what investors should look at, follow the dollar. Look at the dollar. If it's you hear talk of heavy selling with the U.S. dollar, and coincident that would probably see some sharp rallying in price of gold and silver, I'd get very nervous, and I'd get, if you already don't have some, get some physical gold, but hold it through the crisis. It doesn't help you as a hedge. For example, you buy the gold, let's say you buy gold at $1,100 or $1,200 where you are now. Gold gets up to $10,000 an ounce. Well, what the gold does is it preserves the purchasing power of the money that's put into it. And if you're going to end up in a system where the dollar, let's say, becomes worthless, you want to hang on to that gold until the system has resolved itself. Because what might be 10,000 in gold could become 100,000 gold, could be 100 million, who knows? But it's not, what it does is, again, is it preserves the existing purchasing power. It keeps your assets from becoming worthless, which they would if you just held them in paper.
Very good. All right, John Williams, we appreciate you taking time today during this holiday. And while feeling under the weather, any other contact information you'd like to leave with the listeners?
I think you got it, shadowstats.com. Always happy to hear from people looking at the site and interested in what we're doing.
John Williams, we appreciate your thoughts. Please feel better soon. We look forward to hearing more from Shadowstats in 2017.
Again, thanks for having me, Chris.
David Morgan pens the Morgan Report, covers economic news, trends, overall financial health. And welcome back, David Morgan.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be back.
You are going to be doing interesting seminars, online seminars, where you'll be looking at this massive $200+ trillion debt. I'm sure you've heard of, Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff at Boston University, and he's been talking $199 trillion to $220 trillion in debt. These numbers start to lose all sense of reality when you get, this high. I mean, we're talking 10, 20 times everything produced in the United States by every man, woman, and corporation. These are enormous numbers. Tell us the implications, please.
Well, the implications are that you can't live a lie forever. I mean, I've probably said this many times, but it bears repeating. I mean, if you cannot print wealth, and we can't print our way out of this mess. And yet that's something that hasn't worked. So I don't know if it's Einstein that said it or not. It's attributed to him often, that continuing to do the same thing over and over and expecting a different result is a definition of insanity. So I can clearly state that the banking system at large, central banks in particular, are insane to believe that after the QE1, QE2, Operation Twist, QE3, which is QE to infinity, and the European banks following suit, is going to solve a problem when clearly it hasn't. And yet this is the only methodology that they really have. And then, of course, they have, I guess, another methodology, which is rhetoric. They have the ability to come out in public and talk the markets up or down based on this idea that they're going to change the interest rate, which changes the yield curve slightly on the bond market or the debt markets. But this is all smoke and mirrors. Basically, the curtain on the Wizard of Oz has been drawn back. And as continuing with that metaphor, there's only a few of us, maybe 5-10%, that have actually pierced through the veil, through that curtain, and seen it's this little man pulling levers like hell won't have it. And nothing's really taking place other than a bunch of, again, smoke and mirrors. The other maybe 80-90% are beginning to see through the veil and realize that no matter what is said and what is done, then nothing is changing for the better. And as the confidence factor declines more and more on a global basis, the confidence will lack of confidence will cause a run to gold. And that run to gold will spill over into the silver market in a dramatic fashion, because silver is a smaller market and more affordable for those that have lost confidence. Not so much in a monetary system, although that's certainly a big, big part of it, but basically lost confidence in their governments to take care of them, for their corporations to take care of them, for anybody outside of themselves to take care of them. And this is a situation that very few in the Western cultures, the Anglo-American Empire, Europe and America, or North America primarily, is that if you work, this job for 30 years, you've got this pension. If you pay into the social safety net program of some sort, that you will be in good shape, that if you've got a savings set aside within some government bond, you're going to get a certain yield and all these things. And yet none of those things are guaranteed. What is almost guaranteed is that all fiat systems fail. This one is failing. It hasn't failed far enough in every case that the majority has lost confidence. And I don't think at the top of the market, when the gold and silver prices on paper terms are astronomical, that everybody has lost faith in the system. But at that point, for all practical purposes, everyone has lost faith in the system. Now, can that be circumvented or headed off? And the answer is possibly. But the probability of that becomes less and less and less every tick of the clock. I mean, with what's going on in the geopolitical scene, which you may or may not get into, is screaming that this war mongering that's taking place is more than rhetoric. Bombs are being dropped. Lives are being lost.
Give us an idea whether or not you think this could be an end to the uptrend, or it's just a healthy correction.
Believe me, and I don't want to be data-driven, although data does drive some of my analysis, but I'd say some, not all. I think it's probably I'm not certain it's over, but I think the majority of it's over. I was very cautious when we had gone, 6 months or more into this uptrend, which was very, very enjoyable. Those that were members of the website were getting cautious statements from me as we're going into a top-level consolidation. And I recommended to all of the website members to consider taking partial profits or hedging their positions. And I did it early, which is when you want to do it. You want to do it when you're near the top. You don't want to do it after the fact. And I got a little bit of blowback. I mean, I put out some Twitter feeds about, taking profits and, look out below. And everyone's saying, what below? What's wrong? And some of my own website members, well, if it's only going to be a 30% correction, then, I'm not going to do anything. And, of course, I can't trade for anybody. And everybody's an individual. You got to do what's best for you. So I did have a caveat, Chris, and that was it's possible that the trading had changed so much, and it has, that there could be a final move up rapidly. And I explained how it would be done, how it would be accomplished, and basically it wasn't really worth trading unless you were very nimble. But the commitment of traders was so obvious that there had to be a sell-off sooner or later. And of course, it just droned on and on week after week. And I'm starting to think, could it be different this time? And I stuck to my guns saying, the probability is so high that they will win again. We just really need to take some profits and hedge, or both. And of course, it took place, recently, and the sell-off was rather dramatic. What's interesting so far, and what makes me hesitant to say it's over, is that on a commitment of traders basis, the open interest has dropped enough in gold for me to give a pretty positive outlook that, yeah, it's probably over, the majority's over. But on a commitment of trader basis in the silver market, it's been rather insignificant, which means that I am not comfortable saying that there isn't more to come. However, the Chinese are back in the market, the SGE, the Shanghai Gold Exchange, which basically has been taking on the long positions that the commercial traders have been selling, or the opposite of the trade, the shorts in the commercials. So more to be determined. I do think it's going to take a bit of time. I was talking to one of my associates before this interview, and he asked me what I felt at this time. I'm a thinking man, but some of this is gut feeling and a lot of experience. And it feels like we must remember that the sell-offs in the metals for this last 4 or 5 years until the bottom, which was, early December or late November last year, we have gotten the lowest print in the markets basically on the last trading day each and every year for several years in a row, which means with this sell-off, are we going to experience that again? And the answer is TBD, to be determined. The rhetoric out there in the mainstream financial press is pretty negative gold, although there's a little bit of positive. And you're also seeing some well-known, pretty savvy type of investment firms that are actually coming into the gold market, Dreyfus being one that made an announcement today that they might be looking into the sector. So it's stronger than it's been. I am convinced that the bottom is in. And how patient do we have to be? Is this going to be a quick turnaround of, a few weeks? Or are we going to have, months ahead of us where some of the newly arrived to the bull market next move up are getting discouraged after a few months and decide to bow out?
You could see, as you've written recently and talked about, a potential V-bottom near the 200 period, the XAU gold and silver. All three found solid support. I'd like to move on to junk silver. You've been a big proponent, as have we. When times get tough, it doesn't take an even great depression or great recession, as we saw in 2008, 2009. Barterability, the usability of your precious metals. I mean, you might have a giant stockpile of silver, and we hope all our listeners do, in some warehouse somewhere or hidden hopefully on the premises, underground, who knows. You really can't take a 1,000-ounce or 100-ounce bar down to the local store or to your neighbor and say, hey, can I buy a couple bags of grain or wheat or whatever it is that's going to help you and your family get through these difficult times, pay the mortgage, pay the rent. Junk silver pre-1965, you know, U.S. silver coins do have a tendency to hold their value. People trust them because they're obviously de facto real money, and they have that silver backing, oftentimes 90%, and you can get them in very small denominations. One dime, you know, is basically 1/10 or 1/11 of an ounce of silver, can be found at fire sale prices.
Well, Chris, you did an excellent overview, and I'll just give you the rule number one of the 10 rules of silver investing. When I was asked to write the 10 rules of silver investing so many years ago for the investing rules book, that were really, it's kind of an honor to be in there because there were some really notable investment people that were asked. I mean, Investing Rules is a global investor book, which includes tactics, strategies, and insights relied on by 150 of the world's most respected financial experts. So to be held in that class was kind of an honor. But, you know, I just started right off the bat with the worst case. And so rule number one, when all else fails, there's silver. So if the grid goes down, the banks close, there's a bank holiday, the stock market, circuit breakers pop. I mean, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but I'm saying if something similar were to occur, if there's a hurricane in your area, I mean, there's other scenarios that doesn't have to be global or nationwide or even statewide. It could be, you know, it could be an event in your city or whatever. So anyway, when all else fails, there's silver. That's rule number one. And I go on to state, no one likes to be a prophet of doom. But the simple truth is, silver is the world's money of last resort. Should a severe economic collapse occur, leaving paper assets worthless, silver will be the primary currency for purchase of goods and services. Gold will be a store of major wealth, what will be priced too high for day-to-day use. Thus, every investor should own some physical silver and store a portion of it where it's accessible in an emergency. I mean, I think that's pretty succinct. Certainly, I would, if I was going to change that, the only thing I would change is that should a severe economic collapse occur or an emergency situation locally, because again, it doesn't have to be a global or nationwide or even statewide or countywide. It could just be, you know, your situation in your little hamlet somewhere. And is everyone going to take a silver dime? And the answer is probably not. However, it's pretty easy to negotiate real silver, especially in an emergency, as a barter mechanism well beyond almost anything else you can name. And it's been done, you know, time and time again. So certainly thanks for bringing that up. In these trying times, I think it behooves everyone just to think on their own. You know, you can agree with me. You don't have to. But there isn't much harm in owning, you know, let's say face value, $100 in silver dimes. I mean, not only do you have an investment potential that could go up, but you also have an item that in the case of an emergency, it's pretty handy to have it.
A handful of silver dimes, you can pick them up anywhere. If you don't have a coin shop near you, you've got eBay. If you don't have eBay, there's 100 other places. What a fantastic investment. You can still get them sometimes at spot. Could be invaluable. Let's move on to something more timely. The Chinese yuan. You know, it was recently added to the SDR. It's now alongside with the greenback as a reserve currency. Of course, the IMF promoting. I'd like to know what you think this might mean for gold miners and physical precious metals on a forward basis. We have a new contender for reserve currency on the block.
But what it means for the miners and the precious metals, I won't comment on because I'm still studying the situation, but I can give you probably even a bigger, better picture. What it really means is the Chinese are in no rush to have a gold-backed yuan or have gold in the currency system. It appears, at least from all of my analysis and those that I have, let's say, over in China, that the Chinese political elite are very happy to go along with the Western banking institutions and play the currency game just as far as it'll go, which comes back to our initial discussion, where, you know, continue to do whatever doesn't work in the currency market. So in other words, you know, print more fiat, even though it's not working. So now that the Chinese are in the game, so to speak, or welcomed in by the Anglo-American Empire, and they're allowed to sit at the table as a metaphor with the SDR, and the SDRs can be issued on what's called an MSDR, which is a marketable SDR, which is basically a bond, and the Chinese can opt some of their U.S. dollars and create SDRs, this gives them a lot more clout. Where they can continue to play the currency game. And if you read Jim Rickard's book, I think that he's honest about the SDR. He pretty much makes a case that there is no subset that's responsible for the debt of an SDR. I mean, the responsibility of the United States debt is the U.S. taxpayer. I mean, every U.S. taxpayer owes $165,000. Well, good luck getting that. So unless everybody's got a spare 165K sitting around, you know, good luck getting it paid back. So just continue to go further in debt, borrow more. So the idea with the SDR is that just the banks hold the debt and they aren't, you know, there isn't any populace that's responsible for it. So you can make this charade continue. And I don't want to misquote Jim. I don't have the book in front of me. It's not on my desk this morning. But he basically says it's going to work as long as you can fool most of the people. It is my words, not his exact words, but that's the idea that he gives in the book. In fact, he says about three times in about as many paragraphs that, you know, the SDR idea gives the bankers another mechanism to continue this, I'll call it a game, this system of printing money and prosperity, quote unquote prosperity, by continuing the system. So I said a lot to say this. I think the Chinese are very happy to go along with that system. Where I'm not convinced is that the Russians are. I think Mr. Putin is of a different mindset. And I think he is, and I don't want to sound like I'm anti-American. I mean, I love my country, but remember, love of country doesn't mean love of government. Mr. Putin is a situation where I'm not sure that he is very favorable to this whole SDR situation. And the BRICS, of course, are not. And, of course, that includes China. So it's a bit of a conundrum, you know. What's really going on here? Is it spy, counter-spy, triple spy? We had double agents, triple agents. I really don't know. I really have looked at it as hard as I possibly can through my lens and the people I know and the people that I trust. And there's many in our community that think it's a big setup. The bankers are sitting on top. It's just a problem, reaction, solution. That it's going to come out with a global currency, a global system, and all the elites are going to sit on top and laugh at us. I am not buying that totally. I do believe that there is a breakaway. Now, whether it's the BRICS or Russia alone or part of the BRICS, I really don't know. But I don't think that they're all cozy. I mean, just look at what we know for a fact. What's going on between the neocons and Russia is frightening as heck. We already touched on it once, but this is not just drums of war. This is getting very, very serious.
Just read an article across the wire that Russia is insisting that all of its students are returned home in line with your idea of the drums of war. They're preparing. They're not just talking. That's not just saber rattling. They're concerned that something big is coming. I'd like to talk a bit about the Metropolitan Plan, which I still feel is not getting a lot of play in gold circles. A sort of a cabal of folks who are planning for negative interest rates, NERP rates, in the United States, where we would follow the path of the ECB. And, of course, the BOJ, and now the PBOC, the People's Bank of China. That's for the big lenders, the overnight lending rates, where we could see policymakers make an abrupt U-turn in our overnight lending rates.
Yeah, the best article is by Porter Stansberry, and it's in the Crux. You can Google it and probably read it. I will comment on it. Certainly, one comment I've made, probably haven't made enough in the public domain, and perhaps not even in for the website members, is the bankers seldom lose. This is a fact. What they basically do is when the system collapses or is collapsing, they have this big meeting with, you know, the G7, the D20. You look at it after post-World War II with Bretton Woods, and they set up a new system. And so if you look at the Metropolitan Plan, basically there's three bullet points. And the first thing you have to understand is the world system of paper money is unraveling. Well, anyone that listens to a show like yours knows that. The second thing is that as the crisis unfolds, people in and around government who understand how to use the country's gold will be reestablished in the financial order. So that's something that, as you said, isn't talked about very much. Now, the question I ask on that second bullet point is who has the gold? And this is where we come back to the China and the SDR, because at the end of the day, I don't think it's going to be a poker game where you can bluff and say, I've got this much gold. I really think maybe not on a publicly disclosed basis, although that'd be the most transparent and the most fair way to do it, in my estimation, perhaps in a veiled way. And it's my contention that very little unencumbered gold exists is owned by the Treasury of the United States. And a great deal is owned in the East, particularly China, Russia, and India. So then the third bullet point is, the third thing you have to understand is that government will almost surely do something to prevent you from buying gold when the panic comes. So as this unravels and as the, let's say, banking elite try to maintain their power by last chance efforts, which means probably implementing gold into some portion of the new currency system, whether it be tied to the SDR, whether it be backing of bonds, whatever. There's a lot of things that could take place. I believe it'll be some type of gold cover, which means it'll be partial backing and not fully exchangeable. It will be amongst the bankers only, and gold is implemented to gain confidence on a global basis. But as far as really being sound money again for the masses, you can rule that out, in my view. You could protect yourself. So the third point is that as this is implementing or being implemented, there are several things that could take place. One would be, one, the system will take care of itself. The paper price of gold could get out of the ability of the average person to even buy an ounce. That's one. Another one is a high taxation on it. Another one is preventing it from being bought due to certain edicts or mandates by government or whatever. So the idea here is that this system, when they have to go to the ace in the hole, the last resort, the last thing they can do, the one they really don't want to do, the one after the currency system / SDR, if it works, plays itself out, then you can pretty much bet your bottom dollar that gold will enter into the equation in some way, shape, or form. And you should be or could be positioned prior to that and be very grateful you did. And let me caution somebody, or should I say everyone listening, and most know this without me voicing it, but some people get the idea after listening to somebody on, you know, the precious metals and get the idea that this is, you know, the only way to protect yourself and to be safe is to get precious metals. Well, that's probably a true statement. But when you buy life insurance or house insurance, fire insurance for your home or automobile insurance, you don't put everything into it. You put in what you need. And that's what I like to stress. I mean, 10%, one of the 10 rules of silver investing, when I wrote that, rule number 10 is too much of a good thing is too much. That's kind of a rough quote. I forget the exact wording. And so 10% is enough for most people. So, you know, a handful of silver coins, maybe, you know, a little bit of gold if you can afford it, that type of thing, doesn't mean that you have to overdo it. And this is a problem that I've seen again and again and again, is that people, and some with very, you know, very successful people that have, you know, going concerns, good small businesses, make a, you know, fairly substantial amount of money, and they overload in the sector because it makes sense. But they're playing kind of on their fears, and I don't want to put on, you know, anybody's fear. I don't like, you know, playing the fear card. I'm sure I come across that way at times. I don't mean to. These are, you know, until they happen, are hypothetical, but many of them have happened in history. So I don't want to downplay it too much. Probably overtalked it, but is this viable? Yes. Will governments go to gold? I think they will. How will it take place? I think this Metropolitan Plan gives a pretty good outline. I think if you're interested in it, you should, you know, Google it and read it for yourself and determine what you think about it.
Any other topicality that you'd like to add to the discussion?
Well, what I would like to do is urge everybody to go to the new domain, themorganreport.com. Get on our free email list. All we need is a first name and a primary email address. And I will send you for free the Riches and Resources Report, which gives you two movies to watch and a lot of other information. One is on stacking silver and gold in a very convenient manner. But the two movies are The End of the Age of Empire. It's called the Four Horsemen film. And the second one is The Empty ATM, which is a documentary about the financial, or I should say the currency crisis that occurred in Argentina in 2000-2001. So those are two movies worth watching, let's say, over the weekend, especially if you have somebody in your family that doesn't really understand the dynamics of where we are in the global economic system and what's going to take place in the not-too-distant future. It's for free. You get on our free list. These are gifts that I've put together for everyone, and it's certainly something that I would like to see more and more people, you know, come into the fold, so to speak. On top of that, you'll get mailed once a week with our insights. And I'll admit we do some advertising on that list. I basically, you know, I needed to stay alive during this 4 or 5 year bear market. And believe me, without our free email list that we could use as a revenue source from time to time, without that, you know, I might have gone out of business like many of my compadres that are no longer publishing in the gold newsletter space.
This is a go-to resource. David Morgan, we're going to look forward to having you back on the show in 2017.
Thank you, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garnero, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. We'll be right back.